before I introduce Jean, Abby Friedman, our Director of the Municipal Assistance Center, asked me to reiterate that all of the materials and presentations today are intended for educational purposes only and should not be considered legal advice. And I mentioned something about red tape earlier. There it is. I got ahead of myself. As you may be aware, MAC responds to member inquiries, but due to the specific nature of certain calls, we may direct you to the Department of Health or your own town attorney. Thank you very much.
My name's Jean Bergman. I'm a senior assistant city attorney for the city of Burlington. I've done that for 12 years. Before that, a little bit before, I was a city councilor in the city of Burlington for 6 years. So I've sat in the seat of your select boards and have some experience with that. I am not going to give you legal advice. If you ask me a question that relates to that, then I'm going to answer in a hypothetical. If I do that, and will refer you to your town attorneys and to your town managers. This is educational and is really designed to give you some framework that that you can use, and it's based on my experience. This is in an area of the state, Chittenden County, where the municipalities actually have a lot of resources and will often employ town attorneys to do them, to do a lot of different things. And so I may give you something from my experience that is somewhat different than yours, and I accept that, and that's perfectly okay. This is just education for us all. I want to start by finding out how many of you have written either emergency or regular health orders, formal documents. So that is about 20%. How many of you who have written those orders have had full evidentiary hearings with your select board? You've actually had to go and present your case to the select board to get them to actually issue the order. Three of you. And of you three, how many have gone up to the state board? None of you. We had the luck, I think, as a lawyer, and that's the other thing. I was the interim director of the Code Enforcement Office, City of Burlington, two stints, about 20 months in total. My successor is here, Bill Ward, as are a lot of people from Burlington. I thank you. He's a keeper, so maybe I won't have to do this again. But I was also the city's health officer last year when the pandemic flu epidemic and the state health work on that was happening, as well as during the time that the health order was issued that you have as an example. But we did have in the city the opportunity to go to the state board and have an order presented. I actually didn't do that, but helped with the preliminary work on that, and it was successful. Here is the caveat. I want to also give credit to the person who helped me do a PowerPoint. I am not really, for those people in Burlington do know that, a real technical person, but a 13-year-old who is the daughter of an attorney in my office helped me do this. So I'm really pleased with that. The first thing I want to impress upon you is that you are not alone. How many are on the listserv? The listserv, the health officer listserv. So about half, or maybe even more, 60%. I would encourage you to do that, even though there's a lot of chatter on there that can be aggravating. I'm on it right now still, and I mean, it's a mixed, it can be mixed, but you know what? It's really, really important, I think, to be able to hear what our colleagues are doing and to be able to see how things are processed. But not only is the listserv a big help, but you also have the manual that is online, and in that, Chapter 3 is the key area that I'm going to be talking about. The old manual is really useful. There may have been some things in it that did not meet with the department's approval. I'm not exactly sure what they were, but we had it in the Burlington office. I found it to be very, very helpful. And if you have old copies of it, I think that it's worth keeping around. It's not exactly identical. The other key resource, and I cannot advise you enough about this, is to read those statutes. I know you're not lawyers. I don't think many. Are there any lawyers in here? No, except me. I don't think, I may be jaded, but I don't think that it's really written in very poor English or legalese. I think these things are pretty straightforward. Everything that I did in the Burlington office, everything I do now in the city attorney's office, is grounded in these statutes. That's all I'm trying to do, and that's what I'm going to try to walk you through a little bit of in the hour that we've got. It's important to just recognize the difference between an emergency order and a regular order. We know that the emergency orders are ones that you actually write, right? You write them because you've got to immediately eliminate that health risk or that health hazard. The regular ones, you don't even need to write an order right off the bat, right? You can issue a notice of intent. You put in your the reasons why you're going to be seeking a health order with it. You attach the evidence, your photos, statements, if you do an affidavit, all of that stuff, and the procedural rights, and you send it to the other side. You send it to the select board, and off you are running. I happen to think, and the way that we did it while I was at the health department of Burlington, was to write these notices as if they were health orders. And you can say, this is a notice of intent to seek the following health order. And then you just write the health order. I think it will save you a step. It will make your select board's job much easier because, after all, they have recommended you. They have the confidence in you to have recommended you. Some of you, I know, believe that this is not a great recommendation and it's a burden, but I don't believe that if they didn't have trust in your judgment, that they would have recommended you to the commissioner. Every select board is different. Many of our select people and boards are skeptical of the use of government power, and there is a lot of reason to be skeptical. And we have a lot of weight that we carry around, and we have to use it judiciously. But being able to help them and do it based on what the laws are allows us to really focus on our mission, which is to eliminate those hazards and risks. And we can do that right at the beginning by styling our work in a manner which will make it easier for them to find that there are violations and there are hazards and risks that need to be abated. There are these basic things in your orders. Now, this is absolutely true. Your orders have to lay this stuff out. But as you go up the line, and you might even get it all, it may all go up to the Vermont Supreme Court, they will cut you some slack if it's not exactly perfect. So I try to do things as right as possible, but I understand that, you know, there are challenges in terms of time. There are challenges in terms of the competition for the resources that you need, a whole lot of things that go, and also that you're not lawyers. So the law does say that if you get this stuff in there, it's going to work. But I think that it really helps to have a framework that allows you to make sure that you are doing it and you're covering all the bases. Why is it that you're allowed to do this? Every health order should cite sections 126, which is about regular health orders, or 127, which is the emergency health order. And 602 are your powers. 602A give you those powers. It tells the world, I got the right to do what I'm doing. That's really important, because everybody has the right to challenge us and say, no, you don't. And our job at the very beginning is to make sure that everybody knows we do, and that we do. Not only that everybody else knows it, but that we know it. And it's not just because we said so. That is not good enough, in my opinion. I don't think it's good enough in anybody's opinion. There can also be local health rules. In the city of Burlington, we adopted a regulation that requires establishments who allow people to smoke outside using a hookah or hookah type of, a water pipe or whatever you want to call it, a Turkish pipe. And if they post a warning, the regulation was adopted by the city of Burlington pursuant to section 613 of Title 18 of the Vermont Statutes Annotated. Commissioner approved it. You can have local health regulations that are adopted by your local Board of Health, which is virtually everybody. Burlington's an exception, but virtually everybody has it. The Select Board as being the local Board of Health. There may be other regulations that you can refer to, and we can talk about them later. Every order's got to have a findings section, and it's statements of the evidence that are relevant to showing that the order should be issued. They are the facts. But I was just reading a Vermont Supreme Court case last night, and the Vermont Supreme Court made a very important statement in a case from January of 2010. They said, findings of fact are not just a recitation of the evidence, of the testimony. It's sort of like the facts. There's a table here and a chair back there, and this is, like a dais. Well, the finding of fact, the fact is that this is a dais, and what supports that are these evidentiary things around it. So be careful not to just say, well, he said this, and that's all you say in a finding of fact. In a way, what you're doing, it's not quite a conclusion. It gets really, esoteric, and this gives lawyers a bad name, I think. But by and large, it's a little bit different than just saying somebody said something. Because what you're doing is you're saying these are the facts. And what you're actually doing is presenting them to a body that's going to agree with you and put their name on it. So you get to do that. The conclusions tie all these facts together. And they attempt to get you to one of four places: that you're preventing a public health hazard, okay? That you are mitigating a significant public health risk, that you are correcting a violation of a health statute, of a rule, or a permit condition. So I guess there's three things there. And then the last thing that the order should do is tell the person what to do. You can be prescriptive, you can be not prescriptive, it depends on the circumstance. Austin, at the very first one of these sessions down in Randolph, cautioned everybody about being too prescriptive around the remediation of mold. And he can go into that more in terms of the health, the housing, rental health housing code. But there are times where it's pretty simple. You remove the garbage, you remove this particular thing. So, you got this job in part for your common sense. And a lot of These orders are based on that. What you do need to do is just as you're writing an order, you need to be thinking a little bit farther ahead. Because if, generally speaking, if you're at the point of having to write a health order, then the person is not necessarily doing the right thing to begin with and needs a little bit of help to get it done. And so even when you tell them, because remember, I think it's section 124 of the statutes talks about voluntary compliance, right? 80% of you have never written an order. And that's because you get voluntary compliance. When voluntary compliance doesn't work, then you've got to use other means. Well, there's no reason to think that necessarily because you write an order, they're going to comply with that. So part of your order needs to make that clear, and you need to be thinking further ahead. Now, your supporting evidence has to be included. We're talking about defending this. We're talking about defending it in front of people at the select board level who don't know what this is about, right? They're not involved. You've got to convince them. You're intimately involved. You need to have the supporting evidence because it's the law and because you're never going to convince anybody if you don't have it. I encourage our folks to write their stuff out in affidavit form. It gives it a level of officialness and surety, and I'm forgetting the word, it's not coming right to my mind, that says that this is the real thing. The new director of code enforcement for the city of Burlington used to be a detective, among other things, in the Burlington Police Department. And I was really pleased that he had that experience. It reinforced something that I had been telling people right when I got there the second time around, which is you are not just traffic cops. You are also health detectives, right? If it was just, if it happened right in front of you, like somebody going through a stop sign, this job would be easy, but no, it's not. You've got to actually go out there and find evidence. There is a period of time there'll be a lapse of time between when you gather that and when you finally go places to present it. That will get it. And every means of being able to lock in the dates that you found this stuff. We're going to take questions at the end just so that we can do this in an orderly fashion for the taping. Otherwise, the other ones, you would have had the benefit of doing that. But I really recommend you making sure that you can tell a judge, a select board, that real finder of fact, when something happened, and then you can really prove it. So date stamping, your photographs, writing notes at the time, so you can say, yes, I did my investigation. I went back. I wrote my report, or I wrote my notes. Then when I'm there, having you present it to that body, and I'm going to be more formal because that's how I'm charged to do it, and you don't remember, I'm going to show you it, and I'm going to ask you when you wrote this and did you write it at the time, because dollars to donuts, if you wrote it, if you saw it 3 months ago, but you wrote it last night, your credibility is not all that high, right? When you're engaged in writing orders, when you've gotten to the point, and I think that you do need to be doing this work with an eye to needing to go through these steps to begin with, you need to be able to have all that credibility. You need to be able to show that this really needs to happen. You can present this. The rules of evidence do not apply at the select board level. faint. There's nothing in the statutes that require that. When you go up on appeal to the commission level, to the commissioner level, and to the state board, they operate under Title III's Administrative Procedures Act. And there they've got a modified rules of evidence and civil evidence, civil procedure approach to things. I really encourage people, again, as I've said them now several times, to be thinking that you may have to go that far. So you want to build your case with that in mind. Because if you don't and you have to get there, it's going to be that much harder. Asking witnesses to appear instead of giving their hearsay evidence may work at the select board, and as you know, the evidence here proves the overwhelming majority of you don't have to go this way. But if you do, you want live people there. You don't want to get into a situation, if you can help it, of having to say he said this, she said that. But if they can't, having sworn statements gives them a level of veracity, which I think is really important. And of course, we're now talking about defensible orders. The purpose of this stuff is to make sure that your orders will stand up. The evidence that you're gathering needs to support those essential elements. And that's what you are not only gathering, but that's what you're putting in for your findings of fact. And you're going to get a lot of stuff that sort of helps you paint the picture and put all the colors on the edges, but isn't really all that important. And you need not to get lost in those weeds. I think it's really important. Am I boring you guys yet?
No.
So, let me just flip these all up and tell you that I did not put in a slide for emergency orders. I figured that out on after I had sent this in to Abby. And so I had to write my notes there. So last one, I had forgotten it. Health orders are about, as I said, the hazards or the risks. You've got to make sure that your facts, your findings of facts, and so your evidence include, now this is for the hazards and risk one, the condition or the agent that is causing the problem. Seems simple, but having read the listserv, we forget these things. We have to always go back to basics. It's why we go back to the statute and the definitions, why Section 2 is so important. If you forget what you've got to do, keep going back to that. You've got to be able to identify the harm or the potential harm that's posed by the condition. Have people looked at the department's website and the podcasts? How many people, raise your hand, have looked at the posted podcasts that are online? It's a great resource. In and of itself, I really would advise you to do that. One that's relevant to this is the one that was done on asbestos. And in that podcast, you will see what asbestos is and what its harm is and how it, how the vectors that allow it to cause that harm. There are resources out there that you should be availing yourself, that you can be availing yourself, and that's one of them. I have found on the listserv that most of the confusion comes about when people ignore the public nature of it and don't analyze the public nature of it. And a lot of the questions could probably be answered if people more rigorously did that. I've got a slide on that, but you've got to deal with this being a public health hazard or a public health risk. Because if it's not, this is not the means by which to deal with it. the law, the order we've talked about. Is it public? The statute makes this crystal clear. If you do not consider this, I would say that your order is defective. That doesn't mean that you can't get it to work. Things work all the time that legally may not meet the four corners of the law. But I'm trying to do things right, and I'm encouraging our people to do things right. The number and characteristics of the person at risk, persons at risk. So in the health order that we put in, which I think is in fuchsia, which relates to a controversial issue, which is a outdoor wood boiler. I don't know why I can't remember, but you guys know what I'm talking about. And we know that the people burn wood in Vermont. I'm very happy I don't do it anymore, but it's just part of our culture. It's not necessarily a bad thing. There are rules. When we issued this, there had been complaints for a very long time. And I know the people in Burlington here know when I say it's, but I was the code director the first time around, when I was the code director. Somebody died at UVM. Actually, yeah, one person died at UVM from carbon monoxide poisoning. And we had inspected. We did not do a negligent inspection. There was no notice that there were defective parts that were involved in that. But I swore that I would not, if I was in that place, allow somebody to die on my watch. You know, and I will use the power that I have not to abuse the due process and not to abuse people, but I am going to use this to protect people. And so in this case, where somebody was burning all sorts of garbage in his makeshift wood boiler outside and was choking these kids on East Avenue, which is a densely populated place, I said, I'll be darned if I'm going to sit by and let that happen again. We had had a couple of other cases where we actually did not go after somebody for wood stove activity. And I never felt sort of right to me. It got hung up. These things do happen. This was a case where I could, you know, where we were going to go out there. And if the evidence, if we had a whole neighborhood, if we had children involved, if those children were being choked by this and they gave us the evidence of that, then we were going to try to do something about it, particularly if this availability of private remedies, I really believe that people should solve their problems together, you know, without need to call us in. You know, if I get a problem with my neighbor, I do like to go over there and talk to him instead of calling the cops. Sometimes, though, even when I go over there and they accommodate me, it's not enough. So if the people on East Avenue, if the person closest had said, well, you know, don't burn it, you know, at this time, because that's when we're home, that wouldn't have done it, right? Because everybody else is around is going to be suffering. So the fact that you solved it for me because I'm at work doesn't do it. That's what this availability of effective private remedies is designed to have you analyze. What you're doing is stepping through this stuff all the time. The health risk is a little bit different. Health hazards, we try to eliminate them. They're a real hazard. This is the risk of a hazard. So in your order, you have got to have the probability of experiencing that hazard factored into the calculation, and you have to put it in there. It's okay for it to be up here. This is where it starts. You got to get it down on paper. It's got to be in the order, and the evidence has got to go to it. The magnitude of that risk And these are the different factors that the law says that you need to consider. For the emergency order, which I don't have a slide for, I'm sorry, my oversight on that, you have to include the imminence of it, right? Because it's an emergency. Straightforward. And the substantiality of it. If it's not substantial, but it is imminent, I believe that the Vermont legislature said, write a regular health order and go to the select board and do it in that process. If it's not substantial, even though stuff is happening right now, take the time to give that person due process. And that emergency, it needs to be prevented or destroyed. Okay? That's both in the findings and in the conclusion. You've got to be able to conclude that it needs to be taken care of right now. Okay? And most problems that I've had with officers, be they health, but I work with fire officials, I work with building inspectors, I work with minimum housing inspectors, as well as police officers. We jump to conclusions. We get to the place that makes the conclusion that it is an imminent and substantial risk without explaining, without having the foundation to let that happen. I would caution you against that. I think it is not a good practice. Now, there are orders that can be written not just for the hazard and risk scenario. And that's for violations of statutes and rules and permit conditions like we talked about. These are the three basic things that need to go into that order. You don't need to go through that whole process. It doesn't have to be public. They violated the law. It is public by its very nature. The Vermont Supreme Court has said very, very clearly that when you violate a local ordinance, it's a public nuisance. Assuming that there's a valid ordinance that you've violated, it is a public nuisance. And the municipality has the right to go in and abate it. So these are the things that you need to have in your order. And your findings, your conclusion, and your order need to be directed to this. That statute is that rule. The action that is going to be listed in the findings and the conclusion, and then the corrective measure. Now, let's see, is this too small for you guys? You got it there. I had a lot of stuff to fit in here. My eyes are getting... But what these are examples of the way that your localities can address local health issues by ordinance, by regulation. You've got the authority, your select boards have the authority to pass ordinances under Title 24 and Section 2291 and Subsection 14 if they define them as public nuisances and as the public health, safety, and welfare may require. City of Burlington has its vacant building ordinance. We've got charter authority, which we use. And if I were called to defend that, and I may be called to defend that in the not-too-distant future, I will use this as well to defend it, right? The ordinance itself says that these things are public nuisances. We've made that clear. That's the job of your select board with the town attorney and the town manager to craft it. But you have a big role in knowing your communities and identifying those things that may be appropriate for ordinances and why they are nuisances and how they can be eliminated. All those things. We used to move solely in the traditional world of criminal citations. All ordinances up until 1993 or 94 were criminal. Legislature decriminalized, and cities started to decriminalize ordinances and started to use civil ticketing. And that process has improved. It's a way that you can actually do a lot of this stuff when the voluntary compliance doesn't work and the order itself is going to be a lot of work and you want to look for a middle road. Because when they do not comply with your order, if you go to sections 130 or 131 in Title 18, you'll see that there is a very big stick, right? That stick is civil litigation with, I think it's $10,000 penalties, or criminal. And that's big stuff. But there are lots of ways that you can get to this, to where you want to go, which is as easily as possible. Again, that's why we have in the law the voluntary compliance. Just do the right thing. I got other things to deal with. I don't want to be chasing you all the time. I mean, how often have I said that? Right? It's a mantra, right? So not only does your town or your city have the right to draft ordinances under that authority, but you've got the right, like I was talking about before, to get local regulations. And what you need to do is you need to pass them by the commissioner, who will pass them by their legal counsel. And if there are issues, and there were a couple of little tweaks that we did, then you get them passed, and then there are local regulations. And there can be penalties, there can be, or there cannot. And you can do them under a health order. These are examples of laws that are in the realm of public health that may lead you to write a violation order. Again, I'm going back to that. Maybe you're not going to have civil ticketing. Maybe you're just going to issue health orders. And these are ordinances over the last year. These are things that I saw that really stuck out. I'm going to leave the orders to landlords and tenants, to Austin. We use the city's minimum housing code, authorized under a totally different statute, which is found in Chapter 123 of Title 24, Municipal Housing Codes. But you guys are, by and large, enforcing the state health code related to rental housing. I'm not going to really touch the other ones. Anybody who watched Channel 44's news last night knows that chickens are a big deal in Burlington these days. We'll be working on that for a while. But what I would just say, in each and every one of these, you need to really apply those principles that I gave you in the orders for even beginning sort of to understand this process. It's real. Once you get comfortable with this, then this is going to be a whole lot easier. So, look at that. Not bad. We've got hazard and risk orders, and they've got to demonstrate the public nature of the problem, and they've got to state the condition and the harm, and they have to do that clearly. For the violation cases, this is something that you want to KISS, keeping it simple. Stating the law and how it was violated in a very straightforward manner. You're going to base your findings on the evidence and avoid conclusory statements in those findings. You're going to base the conclusion solely on the findings. You need to be able to look, and you should label. The section is saying findings. I did this presentation well after we wrote that order. And I would write this order differently. So that's what I was saying right at the very beginning about learning and doing things. I absolutely would, based on this stuff. That's why we do continuing legal education. That's why we read cases. That's why we're constantly trying to figure out how to do things better. You want? I would advise you to have sections that say findings, to have conclusions, and then to have the order. So if you're going to have a conclusion, make sure that the facts that you're putting together in that sentence or two sentences have support in that finding section. You can make inferences, but they have to, by and large, the inferences come in the conclusion section, although, as I was saying, sometimes you can do them in the finding section as well. But it's important not to, if you can help it, not to be making big leaps. You need to state clearly what the problem was, that you found a public health hazard, that you found a public health risk, the significance of it, the imminence of it. You should don't leave it to doubt. Say those words. Use that language in there. I think the others. And have a remedy which is logical and that somebody can say, well, where did this come from? You wrote all this stuff and then you're asking them to do something entirely different. Again, I go back. I'll close with this and then we can take questions. I hope you wrote it down so that you, good deal. You were given this opportunity to serve because people trusted you. They trusted your judgment. They trusted your ability to learn. They trusted your ability to deal with people. All of those things. We have tremendous opportunity to do good for the people that live in our state, that come and visit our state, and for all of our folks that, all of our kids and our grandkids, our legacy, so to speak. So I think that my experience with health officers has been that you guys do a great job, and it's really a privilege to have been one of you and to have this opportunity to share a little thing, and that question would now be great.
It's now three.
Cool.
They all deal with definitions and terms. You mentioned affidavit form, subject to the affidavit form.
Yeah.
We should follow the rules of evidence, and we should, where necessary, obtain sworn statements. Are there definitions of those terms?
Well, an affidavit is something that somebody swears to the truth of and identifies themselves and then has a notary notarize that that's what they said and that's who they are. So it's a pretty straightforward form that we can, and I know that Austin was talking about getting something posted, so we can try to post an affidavit that from the city. I'm not in control of those records, but I would ask the current director if that would be a possibility to do. The rules of evidence, you don't have to know the rules of evidence. You need to know that there are going to be certain, there may be up the line certain limits on your ability to describe what happened when you don't have any direct knowledge of it, quite simply. And there are lots of ways that the law tries to make sure that you're just not making stuff up. And that's what you want to go into this with. You want to go into it knowing that if I take a picture, that picture has to fairly and accurately depict the conditions at the time that it's relevant to. And so if it's got a lot of stuff, a lot more stuff, a lot more problems, so that it may confuse things, it's not necessarily a good picture. So if you've taken, if the problem existed in December and you take your picture in March and there's different snow conditions, if the problem has gotten worse, that picture in March, even though all the conditions were there in December, it doesn't necessarily, you won't necessarily be able to get it introduced into evidence. It's not necessarily going to help you, right? Better to take things when they happen and be able to document that or be able to describe it. Sometimes in that situation, do people besides Burlington folks take pictures when they're going out there trying to do things? How many people do that? Okay, this is great. But you know they're two-edged swords, right? I mean, they do show what happened and they do lock you in, but they'll never, ever depict the condition that you really saw. They'll never depict the size really well. They'll never depict the smell. They'll never depict all of that stuff. You know, I mean, I've seen these now for a really long time. They're essential. You got to take them. But you need to be able to balance those with the reality. I don't believe in ambush prosecutions, and I do prosecutions. So in criminal rules, you've got to give the other side all your stuff. You at least have to make it all available, exculpatory stuff. If your picture doesn't really do it, and it actually might, even though it might be used by somebody else the other way, in a criminal case, you've got to give it to them. It's fair to do. And I really do believe that if somebody, even in a health order situation or a civil enforcement action, wants to see the pictures that we've got, even if I'm not going to use them, they're fair game. And if they want them, they should have them, because that's just right. I'm just trying to do justice. So the you need to, if they're not going to fully depict, then you've got to be able to have other means to do that, so that the truth is really portrayed. Before Bill, do you have one more question?
I guess I would ask, what's the difference between a sworn statement and an affidavit?
Nothing.
Yes. I'm just going to say that to follow up what you're talking about, the exculpatory information, it may actually help you, because in the case of the wood-fired boiler, if Matt Perry had brought out and interviewed all the neighbors on that street, and 50% of them said, no, I've never noticed any problems whatsoever. And he only put in the order that people were outraged, the neighbors said it smelled, it was terrible, whatever. And you know that at that hearing, 50% of the people are going to come and say there was no problem. Get it out there. It's fair, like Gene said, but it's actually going to help you be portrayed as being fair and unbiased in the way you present the information. I'm just saying that. And that was, 10 neighbors, 3 of them said they voted no problem whatsoever. 7 of them said the problem was outrageous, they're not going to be able to live here anymore. Something to that effect helps you.
Yes.
Yeah, question. So what was the outcome of the outside burning wood stove?
As far as we know, they're not using it anymore. We haven't had any complaints. The neighbors offered to get him a new supply of wood. He was supposed to get it checked, and I don't believe that they did that. I think he just stopped using it. It just became too much of a problem. So those kids get to breathe. And I get to sleep. Let's go. Let me march down. That'll be a lot easier.
Suppose you come to a place like I did last week, and it appears the tenant is working in an occupation where he's bringing the whole home on his clothes. You can actually see it. And complaining about the landlord is that the house is already contaminated.
Well, I'm not going to give you legal advice, but I would say that you've got two issues there, right? One relates to the health code, the housing health code. Austin's going to deal with that. I love that. You've then have a person who's covered with mold or mold spores. The question is, are those, right, is what he's doing, is that a, does it fit these definitions? You need to go back and say, is this a public health hazard? Is it a public health risk? And you need to do that analysis. I wouldn't automatically assume that it is. If he's getting in his car from work, he's coming home, he's going into his place, and he is taking off his clothes, where is the public being affected by that? Maybe there are facts that you could do, that's what we lawyers do. But, you know, that's a type of analysis. Now, if all of that is causing problems with the house, then, and but there is mold in the house, in Burlington, let me just speak to Burlington. We can write an order to the person who is responsible. But we also tend with housing to write orders to the landlord because they're in control of things. But I'll give you an easy example. Smoke detectors. If a tenant is disabling the smoke detectors, not only are we supposed to be telling them not to, but we're supposed to be writing them tickets. So, and that's in that particular provision, but it wouldn't have to be in that provision. You know, if a tenant is bashing holes in the wall, and you've got enough evidence to show that, you can order them and the landlord, you can order the landlord to fix them in Burlington. Again, I'm going to keep this to the Burlington and the hypothetical so I don't get into trouble here. But you can order the tenants to stop.
You can.
If somebody is engaged in an activity which is in violation of a law or is creating a public health hazard or risk, I believe that if you go to Section 602A, you'll see the authority you have to deal with that. How's that for a lawyer talking? There you go.
Can we just finish it real quick, though? You said there's also mold growing in the apartment. I mean, if the mold is growing in the apartments, regardless of whether he has it on his clothes because he's a landscaper or what have you, being on his clothes is unlikely to contribute to the mold growing on the wall unless there's a source of moisture and a food source for the mold. And if there's a source of moisture, then that is a violation of the rental, that is non-compliance with the Rental Housing Health Code, Section 8C, and that you can then notify the property owner or property manager that they are not in compliance and they need to come into compliance.
And I will continue to let Austin handle the state code on that and not get into, you know, doing some legal advice, but education, yes.
Okay. Three questions. In your order, when you're writing your order, you recommend putting in the remediation section a time frame which the remediation should take place. Six months, or whatever, it depends, but yes.
I mean, as a general point of view, if you don't, then the person has a hard time knowing when they have to comply by, and you don't have a way of saying that they haven't. So now there may be it may be ongoing, and so then it starts to look like it's indeterminate. So the particulars may get a little fuzzier. But by and large, yeah, put yourself. The other thing in that regard, put yourself in the shoes of the person who's getting the order, and go, do I know? If I don't know hardly, if I am, you know, not as smart as me, you know, will I get this? Have I written it so that that person is going to understand and know what to do and when I need to do it by? Because again, you're in this situation, I think, more times than not, because people are have let life slip away from them, or they just don't care. The first person, you know, is less culpable, or, you know, there's not that sort of bad heart thing, but and that happens all the time. But you need to be able to guide them through and make it clear for both of those type of folks. I'm going to run down, yes, and then we'll go down that side, then we'll go down this side.
I'll just go real quick. I tend to recommend that if you go to, like if you're writing up your notes or whatever, take your notes and email them to your town office so that they can be put in a file so there's an actual date stamp on that. That way it can't be argued. This was the day that they were written, and then your town officer can just put them in a file. The other, under violations, let's say maybe our town doesn't have a lot of ordinances, but somebody is in violation of a state ordinance, burning trash or something like that. I presume that that can also be written up because they're violating the state law as opposed to the town ordinance.
You need to look or have the manager or the attorney look at the enforcement mechanisms. That's the way I would do that. And if it's not, if you're going to write an order for that, but it's not clear that it's a health, that it's that there's a health order or a health officer responsibility to that, if it's, then maybe you're going to be flipping it into the hazard or risk framework.
Let me follow up on that too. If it doesn't fall under Title 18, meaning if it's Division of Fire Safety, Division of Public Safety, DEC, you don't have the authority to enforce it. You only have the authority to enforce things that fall under Title 18. However, the exception to that is, I think, if the violations of these things are creating an imminent health hazard, and then certainly if there's no one else to act, then I think to protect the public, you have to act. But if it's a you are not authorized, town health officers aren't authorized to enforce any state reg. Only regulations that fall under Title 18.
But again, I you're absolutely right. So I probably wasn't clear enough on that. But if it can fit in the public health risk or health hazard, then Title 18 gives you that authority. But you need to understand what the statutory framework is and who's in charge. The septic stuff, that's a good example. There are other people that are, you know, charged with dealing with that, and so I see a lot of desire to exert an authority that, you know, you don't necessarily have to exert and feel that you're responsible for. But what you do want to do is make sure that you understand who is responsible out there and try to get them the information to take charge or to help you figure out within the confines of your authority what you can do on it. Yeah. Deborah.
Jane, the definition of public, can you take that a little bit further? Is our tenants, do they always fall under the definition of public? Or is that private?
I mean, I think that the tenancy